You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos. 13 lectures translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 2nd of July, 1921. Today it will be my task to develop further what I began with yesterday. Let me remind you of something that most of you will already have heard from me. When we go through death, our physical body remains behind with the forces of the earth. Our etheric body dissolves into the forces of the cosmos, and we continue our passage, our existence, through the realms that lie between death and a new birth. I went on to add that one can trace back the effects of the formative forces reaching over in the physiognomy of each individual from one life to another. Now, we know that we human beings are essentially threefold in nature, having three independent elements to our nature. I am referring to the formative forces at work in our physical organization, to begin with. We have the nerve sense organization, which is, of course, spread out over our whole body, but is chiefly concentrated in our head. We have the rhythmic organization, the breathing rhythm, the rhythm of our blood circulation, and other rhythms. Then we have the metabolic and limb system, which we can consider as a single organism, since movement is inwardly very closely associated with our metabolism. Now you know that everyone's head has a different shape. We are not thinking, of course, of the physical substances involved, but of the formative forces which give to each head its individual physiognomy, its phrenological expression. If we look at these forces, we shall see how they are carried across from the metabolic limb organization of the previous incarnation. The form of the head, then, is the result of the metamorphosis of the forces within the metabolic limb human being in a previous incarnation. Similarly, the forces at work in our metabolic limb organization in this incarnation will undergo a transformation and give shape to our head in the next incarnation. Thus, once we have understood the forces at work in shaping our human form, we can gain an insight via the concept of metamorphosis through the manifestation of our head today into the metabolic limb system of the previous incarnation, and likewise, through the metabolic limb organization of today, get a glimpse into the head organization of the next incarnation. This view of the world, which plays a certain role in our spiritual science, and in fact has done so throughout the ages, contains the truths concerning repeated lives on earth. These are by no means idle theories, but can be directly derived from a study of the constitution of the human being by anyone who has the appropriate knowledge. The problem is that the direction taken by natural science in our time could scarcely be further from the point of view required to undertake such a study of the human being. If external anatomy and physiology are the only permissible means of studying the human being, there is, of course, no alternative to the blinkered view that liver and lung can be examined in exactly the same way. The liver is placed on the dissecting surface next to the lung and is considered a comparable organ, made up of cells and so on. There is absolutely nothing to be learned from these things with that approach, and two such different organ systems as the lung and the liver simply can't be studied so superficially on the basis of the configuration of their cells, which is the method prescribed today. In order to truly understand the relevant factors, one would have to undertake to learn the methods necessary to gain access to these things. Once these faculties have been acquired in the appropriate way, as described in my title, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, our ordinary access to knowledge, which is externally through our senses and internally in our experience of thinking, feeling, and willing, is enhanced. When we bring about this enhancement by means of the exercises I have often described, our perspective on the outer world changes, and the first outcome is that we realize that it is complete nonsense to talk about atoms in the way that is prescribed by our current view of the world. It is not waves that underlie our sense impressions, our qualitative experiences of yellow, red, the notes C or G, but spiritual substance. The outer world becomes increasingly spiritual the more we develop our powers of cognition. We can then no longer take all the constructs of chemistry and other such ideas seriously. Any form of atomism is thoroughly eradicated from our consciousness once we have enhanced our means of perceiving the outer world. What lies behind the surface of the outer world is spirit. Once we apply this enhanced cognition to penetrate more deeply into what lies within, it is not confused, mystical perception that appears, though it does admittedly have a justified transitional role which has to be explained in the way I did yesterday, but a psychic apprehension of our organs. We really learn to perceive and understand our internal organs. Outwardly, our perception becomes increasingly spiritualized. Inwardly, it becomes increasingly material to begin with. Looking inward is not the nebulous mystic, but the genuine spiritual researcher who will learn about the individual organs. One will be able to discern the differentiated human organism. The only way to reach the spiritual world is indirectly, via a contemplation of our inner materiality. Without acquiring an understanding of our liver, lungs, etc., this indirect approach through our insides will not enable us to develop the kind of spiritual enthusiasm that can lead us out of the confusion of mere mysticism and into a concrete understanding of our internal organs. One consequence of this is that one then learns more about the inner structure of the soul. We learn to let go of the presupposition that our soul life is connected only with the nervous system. It is the world of thoughts and ideas that is connected with the nervous system, but not the world of feelings. These are directly connected with our rhythmic organization, and the world of our will impulses is connected with the metabolic limb system. When I exercise my will to do something, my metabolic limb system must go through a process. The nervous system only serves the purpose of becoming aware of what is going on in my will system. There are no nerves directly connected to the will, no motor nerves, as I have often pointed out. The classifying of nerves as sensory and motor nerves is nonsense. Nerves are all of a kind, and the so-called motor nerves have no other purpose than to sense or perceive what is going on within us. They are also sensory nerves. If we make a thorough study of this, we will eventually come to an holistic view of how the human being is organized. If we take, for example, the liver organization or the lung organization, and study them inwardly using our spiritual faculties, we will come to a certain picture of the surface of the individual organs. What is this surface? The surface of our organs is purely a device for reflecting the life of our soul. What we perceive and think about is reflected from the surface of all our internal organs, and this reflection amounts to our recollections, our memory during life. Once we have perceived and processed something, it is then reflected from the surface of our heart, our lungs, our spleen, etc., and results in our memories. This involves the most diverse organs. If, for example, we are dealing with the memory of, let us say, very abstract thoughts, it is our lungs, the surface of our lungs, that is very strongly involved. If our thoughts are more tinged with feeling, if they have a nuance of feeling about them, it is the surface of the liver that comes into play. As a result, we can give a good description, and in some detail, of the involvement of our inner organs in this reflection, which then appears as memory, as the faculty of recall. It is our soul life that we are considering. We cannot say it is the nervous system alone which acts as its parallel organization. On the contrary, it is the entire human organism which contains the parallel organization of our life of soul. In this respect, there is a great deal of knowledge that was once instinctive and has now been lost to us. It appears in certain words and expressions, but we no longer sense how much wisdom is contained within them. For example, if someone has memories which always tend toward a depressive condition, this was described by the ancient Greeks as hypochondria, abdominal gristle, a calcifying process within the abdomen which results in a reflection arising in the individual which leads to his memories becoming a source of hypochondria. The whole organism is always involved in these things. We have to take this into consideration. Now, when I spoke of the faculty of memory, I mentioned the surfaces of our organs. In a way, everything that we experience strikes the surface, is reflected, and that leads to our memories. But something of these impressions also penetrates through into the organism. In ordinary life, this is processed. It goes through a metamorphosis with the result that the organ secretes something. The organs that carry out this process are usually glandular. They have an inner secretion, and the forces that enter in this way are initially processed during the course of life. But not everything is processed in this way, in organic metabolism and so on. And the organs can absorb something which then becomes latent in them, generating an inner force. This is the case, for example, with all thoughts that we take in, which have to do mainly with the way in which we view the outer world, so that these thoughts result in images of the outer objects. The forces which are developed in these thoughts are stored in our lungs, in the inner part of our lungs. Now, you will know that the inner part of the lung is activated by the metabolism, by the movement of the limbs, and there these forces are transformed in such a way that our lungs become a kind of reservoir into which our metabolic limb organization is constantly playing during the course of life between birth and death. When we die, these forces are stored up. Naturally, the physical aspect falls away, but these forces do not. They accompany us through death and through our life between death and a new birth. When we then embark on a new incarnation, it is primarily the forces that were accumulated in our lungs which outwardly form our heads, which impose on us the physiognomy of our heads. The outer form of our heads, as studied in phrenology, is prefigured in the inside of our lungs in our previous incarnation. That is how concretely one can trace the transformation of forces from one life to another. Then these things no longer constitute abstract truths, but can be observed concretely, just as one observes physical objects in concrete detail. Spiritual science is only really valuable when one can go into concrete detail in this way. Talking in generalities about repeated earth lives and so on is just words. They only take on meaning when one can go into individual concrete detail. If one cannot control what is stored up in one's lungs in the right way, it gets squeezed out, as I mentioned yesterday, rather in the way a sponge can be squeezed out. And then the forces which should really be forming our head in the next incarnation tend to produce abnormal phenomena. usually described as compulsive thoughts or some other form of illusion. It would be interesting to study, at a higher level of physiology, what peculiar ideas appear in patients with advanced lung disease. This is connected with what I have just outlined as the squeezing out of thoughts. Thoughts that are squeezed out in this way are compulsive because they already have formative forces within them. Thoughts that we have in our consciousness under normal conditions should be merely images. They should contain no formative forces and should not be compelling. Throughout the long process between death and a new birth, they do compel us. They are causal and have a formative effect. Now, during everyday life, they should not overwhelm us. Their power should be exercised only in the transition between one life and another. That is what needs to be considered. If you now study the liver in the same way as I have set out for the lungs, you will find forces are concentrated within the liver which translate in the subsequent life as the inner disposition of the brain. The inner forces of the liver in the present life are transferred indirectly through the metabolic organism, this time not into the form of the head as was the case with the lungs, but into the inner disposition of the brain. Whether or not someone is an acute thinker in the next incarnation depends on their behavior in the present one. Certain forces manifest themselves indirectly through the metabolic processes of the liver. If, however, these forces are squeezed out in the present incarnation, they lead to hallucinations or strong visions. What I indicated yesterday in a more abstract way, you can now see concretely. As they are squeezed out of the organs, these things intrude into our consciousness, emerging from the general hallucinatory life that should play into one life from another, and then make their appearance in these ways. Adopting the same approach to what is involved with the secretions of our kidneys, we will see how forces are concentrated there which influence the organization of our head in the following incarnation, this time more in the direction of our emotions. Kidneys, secretory organs, generally produce what has to do with one's temperamental disposition, in the broadest sense of the word, in the next incarnation, but indirectly through the head organization. If these things are squeezed out in the current incarnation, they give rise to all kinds of nervous conditions, conditions which are connected with our excitability, emotional upsets, hypochondria, depression, and so on. Every condition that is particularly connected with that aspect of our metabolism. In fact, everything that has to do with our memory and is of an emotional nature is connected with what is reflected from the kidneys. What is reflected from our lungs or liver tends to have more to do with memories, memories as such. If we look at the kidney organization, we will find the basis of our enduring habits in this incarnation, and the inner part of the kidneys prepares our disposition to one or another temperament in the next incarnation, but indirectly through the head organization. Let us study the heart in the same way. Our heart is an exceptionally interesting organ, also from the perspective of spiritual scientific research. You will know that our contemporary trivial science takes a simplistic approach to understanding the heart as an organ. It is regarded as a pump that pumps blood around our bodies. Nothing could be further from the truth. The heart has nothing to do with any kind of pumping of blood. On the contrary, blood is activated by the responsive nature of our astral body and our I, working together. And our heart moves as a reflex reaction to these movements. The movement of blood comes from within the blood itself, and the heart then expresses what is caused by these forces in the movement of the blood. Our heart is in fact the organ which expresses the movement of our blood. Today's scientists are furious if one mentions this. I once explained it many years ago to a medical researcher. I think it was 1904 or 1905, on a journey to Stockholm, and he was almost beside himself at the notion that the heart should no longer be regarded as a pump, but that it is the blood itself that moves out of its own vitality. Our heart is integrated in the general circulation of the blood, and the heart accompanies it with its beat. What is then reflected from the heart is no longer just a matter of memory or habit, but life that has become spiritualized as it encounters the outer wall of our heart. It is our pangs of conscience that are reflected. We can look at this purely at a physical level. The pangs of conscience that radiate into our consciousness are what is reflected back from our heart as a result of our experiences. This is what is revealed by spiritual research on the heart. If, on the other hand, we look into the inside of the heart, we will find forces gathered there from the whole of the metabolic limb system. It is because everything that has to do with the heart and the forces of the heart is spiritual, and what follows from our actions in outer life is also spiritualized as it enters the heart. Paradoxical as it may seem to someone who is well versed in the science of our time, it is in fact the case that our karmic predispositions are formed in our heart. To speak of the heart as a mere pumping organ is foolish in the extreme, for it is in fact the organ which, through the medium of our metabolic limb organization, carries into the next life what we will there experience as karma. You can see then that once we have become familiar with this organization, we can learn to differentiate it, and its connection with the whole of life extending beyond birth and death becomes apparent. One can then see into the whole structure of the human being. There was nothing to be said about the head in connection with metamorphosis, since our head is simply shed. Its forces have found their fulfillment in this incarnation, having been the transformed outcome of the previous incarnation. On the other hand, what we have in the four main systems of lungs, kidneys, liver, and heart passes over indirectly via the metabolic limb system as forces that form and shape the head of our next incarnation with all its faculties. We must direct our attention to the forces in our present vital organs, which will carry forward into our next incarnation what we are presently experiencing. Our human metabolism is nothing like the bubbling and simmering in a retort that is portrayed in today's physiology. You have only to take one step, and a metabolic process takes place. This metabolic process is not merely the chemical process that can be examined physiologically or chemically, but also has a moral quality, a moral nuance. This moral nuance is then stored up in your heart and is carried forward into the next incarnation as a karmic force. Thus, a study of the whole human being means finding the forces at work in us that will extend beyond this life on earth. Our head is a sphere, which is only incomplete on account of the rest of the organism that is attached to it. Our head is formed in its entirety out of the cosmos. The elements of soul and spirit that remain with us after death must then adapt to the whole cosmos, as the whole cosmos takes us into it. Then, leading up to the midpoint between two incarnations, in one of the mystery plays I referred to it as the midnight hour of existence, we are continually in a process of expanding into our surroundings. We gradually become identical with our surroundings. The part of us that reaches out into our surroundings in this way then becomes the configuration for the astral and etheric bodies of our next incarnation. That is, in essence, what the cosmos determines in the mother. What determines the configuration of the physical body and the content of the eye comes from the Father in the fructification process. This eye, as it has then become, passes over into a completely different world after the midnight hour. It goes into the world through which it can make its way through the fatherly nature. This is a particularly significant process. The fact is that the time leading up to the midnight hour and the time following it, both take place between death and a new birth, are actually very different from each other. In the cycle of lectures I gave in Vienna in 1914, I described these experiences from within. Looking at them from the outside, we would have to say that the eye becomes more cosmic in the first half, leading up to the midnight hour, and there prepares what will pass indirectly through the mother into the next incarnation. Then, from the midnight hour of existence until the next birth, the eye passes over into what used to be known in the old mysteries as the underworld, and indirectly from there into fertilization. The two poles of the human being are thus brought together through the mother and the father, the higher world and the underworld. What I have now said comes from an older instinctive form of knowledge, and as far as I know, was a substantial part of the content of the Egyptian mysteries. The Egyptian mysteries were particularly concerned with leading humanity to an understanding of what were then called the higher and the lower gods, the higher and the lower worlds. In summary, one can say that in the act of fertilization, the polarity of the worlds of the higher and the lower gods is resolved, and the eye passes through the higher and then the lower of these worlds in its journey through life between death and a new birth. The curious nuance that many associate with the higher and the lower worlds today was by no means thought of in the same way by people of ancient times. People of our time always consider the higher world a good one, and the lower the bad. Originally, this nuance did not apply to them. They were considered to be simply the two polarities that had to play their part in the formation of the world as a whole. The higher world was directly experienced as the world of light, and the lower world was the world of gravity, gravity and light as the two polarities viewed more externally. You can see from this how such things can be described quite concretely. In relation to the other organs, I have told you that what flows out of them when squeezed can become hallucinatory life, particularly so in the case of the liver system. However, when the contents of the heart are squeezed out, it involves the system of forces which call forth our particular inclination to live out our karma. Observing how each person's karma works itself out, it can only be described as a kind of hunger and satiation. That is how it should be understood. Let us start by looking at it from the point of view of everyday life and take a striking example. A woman meets a man and begins to love him. Well, now that is the equivalent of cutting out a piece of the Sistine Madonna, a little finger of the baby Jesus, for example, and studying it. You do, of course, have a piece of the Sistine Madonna, but it tells you nothing. Similarly, you are none the wiser when you take the phrase, "A woman meets a man and begins to love him." It is simply not like that. One has to follow the sequence of events that led up to it. Before the woman met the man, she went to other parts of the world, and before that she was elsewhere, and before that somewhere else again. One can find reasons everywhere why the woman went from one place to the other. This is, of course, hidden in the subconscious, but there is some sense in it. It is somehow coherent, and it is possible to follow the trail in this way right back into early childhood. The woman concerned follows a trail from the very beginning that leads to the event in question. From the moment of birth, we have a hunger to do what we do and do not stop until it is satisfied. The drive that leads us to the karmic event is the consequence of this kind of general spiritual feeling of hunger. We are driven by it. We are all like this. We have forces at work within us that lead us on to later events, despite the freedom which is nevertheless present, but operating in another sphere. We humans bear these forces within us, expressing themselves as a kind of hunger that leads to the fulfillment of karma. These forces are concentrated in our heart. When they are squeezed out and appear in our present consciousness, they remain located in our hearts but arise in our consciousness. They form pictures, which in turn give rise to impulses, which manifest as maniacal rage. This can be studied in real-life situations, and is essentially the precocious experience in this incarnation of karmic forces destined for the next incarnation. We must get used to viewing world events quite differently once we have grasped these underlying connections. Of course, if one is prone to outbursts of maniacal rage in the current incarnation, one might be inclined to say, like the king who once ruled Spain, quote, "If God had left it to me to create the world, I would have done a better job of it." Close quote. People do ask, quote, "Why did God create maniacal rage?" Close quote. There are good reasons for outbursts of maniacal rage, but everything that is at work in the world can also appear at the wrong time and in the wrong place. This misplaced appearance in the present incarnation of karmic forces destined for the next incarnation results in maniacal outbursts of rage. In this case, it has been brought about by luciferic forces, like everything else that appears in the world before its due time. Thus, we can literally study what is due to appear in subsequent lives in the abnormalities of the present one. You can imagine what a huge difference there is between what lies in our hearts throughout the whole of our present incarnation and the condition it will be in once it has been through the long process of development between death and the new birth, and then appears in the outer behavior of the person concerned. Nevertheless, if you look into the depths of your heart, you will get a fairly good idea, although it is still latent and not developed into a full picture, of what you will be up to in the next life. You can say, then, not only in abstract terms and in general, that what is now being prepared in the current incarnation will work itself out karmically in the next. Not only that, you can even point out the coffer within which the karma of times to come lies resting. These are things which will have to be seen in quite concrete terms if we are to carry out genuine spiritual research. You can see what huge importance these things will take on when they are studied and become part of our general education. What does modern medicine know about a possible illness of the liver or of the heart when it does not know the most important thing about them? What are they there for? This remains unknown to modern medicine. It cannot even find a true connection between hallucinations due to overstimulation and, let's say, the kidney system, while the calm hallucinations that simply appear and are present, as I explained a short while ago, are liver hallucinations. Hallucinations that appear as if they were creeping around a person, that lead to the person involved wanting to scrape things off, come from the kidney system. These are hallucinations produced by stimuli, which have to do with our emotions and temperaments. Symptoms like this can lead to much more secure diagnoses than the diagnostic tools so widely used today. Purely external diagnostic tools are very unreliable compared to what they could achieve if such things as these were studied. They are all connected with the world around us. I pointed out that lungs, as an internal organ or organ system, contain in compressed form all the compulsive thoughts and everything that we take in as we perceive the outer world in concentrated form. Our liver relates to the outer world in a completely different way. The configuration of lungs is quite different on account of them preserving the substance of thoughts. It is more connected to the element of earth, our liver, which contains within it hallucination per se. Calm hallucination that simply appears is connected with our watery system, with the element of water, and the kidney system, paradoxical as it may sound, is connected with the element of air. One would think, of course, that it would relate to our lungs, but they are connected with the element of the earth, although not exclusively so. It is the kidney system, however, which is connected with the element of air, and the heart system is the organ connected with the elemental warmth. It is formed in its entirety out of the element of warmth. Now, this element, which is the most spiritual, is also the one which absorbs the predisposition for our karma into its uncommonly fine warmth structures. Since the whole human being is related to the outer environment, we can say the following. Our lungs will have a particular relationship with the element of earth in our surroundings, and the liver likewise with the watery element. If we now turn our attention to the earthly qualities of plants, we will find within them, in the widest possible context, the remedies for illnesses that originate in the lungs. If we go on to look at what is circulating within a plant, at the circulation of sap in plants, we will find there the remedy for everything that is connected with the liver organization. By studying the relationships of our organs with their environment, you can find the basis for a rational therapy. Our present-day therapy is a hodgepodge of empirical notes. A truly rational therapy can only be achieved by studying the interrelationships of the world of the organs within us and the world around us. We would then, however, have to overcome within us the yearning for the delights of subjective mysticism. If one really has no intention of progressing beyond Meister Eckhart's well-known, quote, flickering flame of the divine, close quote, etc., if one simply wishes to wallow in the delights within and their beautiful images, without penetrating through these to the concrete configuration of our internal organs, one will not break through to really significant therapeutic discoveries. These can be found on the path of genuine mysticism which penetrates into the inner human being. Just as we can penetrate into our inner core and thus indirectly learn about our passage from one incarnation to the next, when we turn our attention to the world outside us, we can penetrate through the world of the senses, the veil of the senses, into the spirit. There we come into the world of the spiritual hierarchies, which we will not have been able to reach indirectly via the inner path of mysticism, but which is to be found by means of a deeper contemplation of the outer world. On this path we shall also find what at first can only be expressed in the form of analogies. These will not be just superficial analogies, but will genuinely contain deeper relationships within them. We breathe, don't we? And last time I worked out the number of breaths drawn in a 24-hour period. If we calculate on the basis of 18 breaths a minute, there will be 60 times 18 in an hour, and over a 24-hour period of day and night, there will thus be 25,920 breaths taken. We could look at another rhythm, which we share, namely day and night. Every morning as you wake up, you draw your astral body and eye back into your physical and etheric bodies. That is also a form of breathing. You breathe in the morning and out as you fall asleep in the evening. You breathe out your astral body and eye again, amounting to one breath over a 24-hour period. So, one breath per day. That amounts to 365 such breaths in a year. And if you take the average life of a human being as 72, you arrive at roughly the same figure. If I had not taken 72 as the basis, but something below that, I would have arrived at the same figure. That means that if you take the whole earthly lifespan of an individual and see the falling asleep and waking up as one breath, you will have the same number of breathings in and out of the astral body and the eye as you will have taken breaths in a 24-hour period. During a life, you will have had the same number of breathings in and out of your eye and astral body. These rhythms are genuinely related to each other, and they can show us how we are integrated into the wider world. Our life in a day from sunrise to sunset, that is the daily cycle, corresponds to an inner sunrise and sunset that lasts for the period between birth and death. You can see then that we are integrated into the whole cosmos, and I would like to conclude today's reflections by drawing your attention to an idea which I would ask you to dwell on, to meditate on for a while. Contemporary science takes the view, this is the evolution of the world. During the course of this evolution, at one point, the Earth arises. Then, in turn, once entropy has taken its course, the Earth will come to dissolution by heat. If we form a worldview today like the Copernican worldview or any kind of modified Copernicanism, we can only take into account the forces that have formed the primal nebula and so on, and the human being ends up as redundant. Geologists and astronomers take no account of human beings. It would not occur to them to look for the causes of a future world configuration within humanity in some way. We are present everywhere in the world process, but are regarded as redundant. The world process plays out, and we have nothing to do with it. Now imagine it differently. This whole world process comes to an end there, is lost in space. It comes to an end, and as to what happens next, the cosmos will always be found within human beings. We will continue. What we experience as the world today has its origins within our predecessors of earlier times. That is the reality. In the way that books of wisdom convey these things, Christ Jesus points to them as follows, quote, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Close quote. All that belongs to the material world will subside. But what emerges from the spirit and the soul and is uttered in words survives the decline of the world, and lives on into the future. The causes of the future are not to be found outside us. They are not for geologists to study, but must be looked for within us, in the inwardly directed forces of our organization, which will initially pass on into our next earthly life, but then continue on into other metamorphoses. Thus, if you are looking for the future of the world, you will have to look within the human being. Everything that is external will die away completely. A barrier was erected against this understanding of the world in the 19th century. It is referred to as the law of conservation of energy. This law sees the forces at work around us as continuing indefinitely, but they will pass away, disappear. It is what lies nascent within us that will shape the future. The law of conservation of energy is the most wrong-headed one could imagine. In reality, it would translate into humanity being redundant in the evolutionary process of the world. The truth is to be found not in the law of conservation of energy, but in the words, quote, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Close quote. That is the correct expression. Unfortunately, these words stand in direct contrast to one another. The fact that there are certain followers of positive confessions today who wish to be true to the Bible and to theoretical physics only shows thoughtlessness on their part. It is nothing but dishonesty dressing itself up as culturally creative. But this dishonesty within the body of cultural creatives, which is in reality anti-creative, must be rooted out if we are to emerge from decline into resurgence. The end of Lecture 6.